It is Thursday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump grapples with mounting legal woes. A former high-ranking U.S. official is critical of Trump's decision to revoke the security clearance of a former CIA chief.
This president will punish you for saying things with which he disagrees or simply for saying things that make him unhappy. That's not how a democracy works.
And a public art installation imagines New York City's Times Square underwater. It's all ahead. The Trump White House went on the defensive Wednesday, one day after two former close associates of the president became convicted felons. Former Trump attorney Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to campaign finance law violations in connection with hush money payments to two women who said they had affairs with Donald Trump before he became president. In addition, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was convicted of fraud charges not related to the 2016 presidential campaign. As VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports, the twin legal bombshells are likely to add to President Trump's political woes ahead of a crucial midterm congressional election in November.
At the White House, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders stood by the president's assertion that he did nothing wrong.
As the president has stated on numerous occasions, he did nothing wrong. There are no charges against him in this. And just because Michael Cohen made a plea deal doesn't mean that that implicates the president on anything.
In court Tuesday, Cohen said he was acting on orders from then-presidential candidate Trump when he paid off two women to keep them quiet shortly before the election. Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis, said his client may also have information related to the Russia probe, led by special counsel Robert Mueller.
It's my observation that what he knows, that he witnessed, will be of interest to the special counsel. That's my opinion. We'll see.
At a rally in West Virginia Tuesday, Trump again blasted the news media and the Russia probe.
Fake news and the Russian witch hunt. We got a whole big combination. Where is the collusion? You know, they're still looking for collusion. Where is the collusion?
Trump's supporters, like Patty Beavers, are sticking with him.
He's putting America first. He's keeping his promises, just like he said. And I really believe that he will continue on.
Democrats were eager to highlight a new line of attack in the wake of the Cohen and Manafort cases, led by Senate leader Chuck Schumer.
What a swamp. What a swamp. Far worse than the swamp that existed when President Trump took over. He has not cleaned the swamp. He has made it more wretched and more fetid.
The legal cloud hovering above the Trump White House appears to be darkening, says analyst Laura Brown.
There is a sense that momentum is building in both, you know, special counsel Mueller's case, but also with regard to sort of the more questions around corruption and the president, which was revealed with Michael Cohen's plea.
There's also the sense of an embattled president fighting on several fronts at once, says Julie Pace.
We don't know what this will mean for Trump's presidency. We don't know if we will see Republicans and voters turn their back on him. But this is a more serious situation than I think he has found himself in at earlier points in his presidency.
But the legal and political fallout is still a long way from being determined, says Paul Schiff Berman.
Does that mean that he will be impeached? Not necessarily. That's a political process. Does that mean that his supporters will stop supporting him? Not necessarily. That's a question of politics as well.
And speaking of politics, it's now clear that the legal problems involving Cohen and Manafort will be an issue in the November congressional elections where Democrats are favored to make gains. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And in breaking news, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the National Enquirer publisher David Pecker has been granted federal immunity in the Michael Cohen case. Well, the fallout from President Trump's decision to revoke the security clearance of former Central Intelligence Agency Director John Brennan continues. More than 175 former high-level State Department and Pentagon officials added their names to a statement signed by former national security officials criticizing Trump's decision. Trump said last week he was considering withdrawing clearance from a current Justice Department official, as well as other former high-ranking officials. One of them is retired Air Force General Michael Hayden, who is also former director of the National Security Agency and Central Intelligence Agency. He speaks with International Edition's Lori London.
Your name is on the list of other high-level officials whose security clearance the president is apparently reviewing following the decision to revoke former CIA Director John Brennan's clearance. Your reaction to being on the list and that there is a list at all?
Well, I mean, the fact that John has had his clearance pulled, the way I choose to describe that is that he has had something taken away from him that he would otherwise have, and it was taken away from him for political speech, which really is kind of scary. And so in broadest principle, I'm with John and saying this is unacceptable behavior by the government, the president of the United States. Now, with regard to my being on the list, however it works, they make the choice as to who they want to threaten. And whether I'm on the list, off the list, with a clearance, without a clearance, it's not going to change what I choose to say or write or think.
The intelligence community really across the board historically, and for that matter, you know, the military, has been pretty politically neutral. So it seemed even more striking that so many former intelligence and national security officials signed statements in support of Brennan and denouncing the decision to rescind his security clearance. Why is this situation so different that so many people felt compelled to speak out?
So we made it clear that what John said and how he said it was John's decision. And nothing we said was to be construed as in support of or not in support of. There were a range of views. But we all agreed that what the president had done was a misuse of the clearance process. There are 13 criteria, according to executive order, for removing a clearance. John's behavior doesn't begin to touch any of the 13. And so we viewed this, and the McCraven letter, Bill McCraven, the former Joint Special Operations Commander, points this out quite clearly, that it's not just John's clearance, but a whole host of things that seem to be busting the norms that have governed the American presidency for certainly most of our lifetime. And so it was a case where, although the norm for us has been to remain quiet in the public domain, the norm busting going on in the administration was so great that I think we collectively decided that this was a case where we had to act inconsistent with past practice and make the point, because of how dangerous we thought both this specific action and the whole pattern of activity was.
You mentioned dangerous. The longer-term implications, what are they for the U.S. intelligence community and for our national security?
The president's action threatening a group, taking the clearance away from John, was a message to the American intelligence community and other truth-tellers in and outside of government that, given the opportunity, this president will punish you for saying things with which he disagrees or simply for saying things that make him unhappy. That's not how a democracy works. And the president, although he has great authority, and in this case, I freely admit, he's the ultimate authority when it comes to clearances, to use them for this purpose is unarguably a misuse.
Do you think it's creating any potential political polarization in our intelligence community or within the ranks of the military? And if so, what would that do?
So with the people still on active duty, I'm sure their leaders are telling them, we have nothing to do with what John Brennan says. We have nothing to do with what the president does. We'll stick to our blocking and our tackling. We'll do what it is we do to keep America safe. Now, all that said, you've got a lot of people in the retired community who no longer are actively involved in the day-to-day tasks, who've gone out of their way, done something non-traditional because they think what is going on now is so threatening, not just to John, to me, to the small group that's been threatened, but to the broad process of how we govern ourselves. Look, I said on air recently, you know, espionage is frequently conducted by doing some morally ambiguous things. I mean, even like trying to create a source inside a foreign government as his own sense of moral ambiguity. It takes its legitimacy, its justification, only because it is done in the service of a higher moral purpose. And I think most of us were saying in that letter, this question of the United States government acting on behalf of higher moral purposes was under assault because of the behavior of this administration. So although what we said may have made life a little more difficult for the people still inside government, we think we were saving them from an even worse fate, that they would be called on to do the kinds of things they do without that higher moral purpose.
And it would appear the president made the decision without seeking advice or letting his close advisors know, some of them anyway. He certainly, as you mentioned, has the constitutional right. Has something like this, though, ever been done before without seeking the advice of those?
It's never been done before with or without advice. You're absolutely right. He didn't talk to Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence. Didn't talk to Gina Haspel, director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He did it based upon what David Ignatius, who's a very good writer about the American intelligence community, calls the iron whim of the Oval Office. He did it. He did it alone. He did it without consultations. It's quite remarkable. Just think, you have not heard a syllable out of CIA other than we don't comment on such matters. And the director of national intelligence, when asked this, his office responded, the president has absolute authority when it comes to clearances. No attempt to justify, no attempt to explain, no attempt to join consensus. That the thin thread of those answers speaks volumes.
Retired General Michael Hayden, who also served as director of the National Security Agency, speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The U.S. security advisor says he warned Russia against meddling in the U.S. November elections. A Ford executive has been named as U.S. envoy to North Korea. Zimbabwe awaits a Friday court ruling on an election challenge. And a lawyer says Iran falsely charged a former lawmaker who staged a parliamentary protest. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers found evidence of a cataclysmic collision between the Milky Way and a dwarf galaxy some 8 to 10 billion years ago. The astronomers refer to this cosmic crash as a defining event in the early history of the Milky Way. They say the collision between our galaxy and what is being called the Sausage Galaxy reshaped the actual structure of the Milky Way, helping to form the galaxy's inner bulge and outer halo. According to one of the lead researchers, Vasily Belikurov, of England's University of Cambridge and New York's Flatiron Institute, the cosmic collision ripped the dwarf galaxy to shreds, with its stars moving in orbits that are long and narrow like needles. Since the astronomers used data from the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite to make their findings, they're calling the paths of the stars from the former dwarf galaxy the Gaia Sausage. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new art exhibit imagines the effect of climate change on New York City. Even as U.S. stocks enjoy one of the longest bull markets in history, dark clouds are on the horizon, one being growing trade tensions with China. Another $16 billion in U.S. tariffs of 25% went into effect Thursday, completing the first round of $50 billion in penalties over Chinese economic practices. Hearings are underway this week to impose U.S. duties on an additional $200 billion in Chinese imports. That number could skyrocket to $500 billion. China has responded in kind and vowed Thursday to take the dispute to the World Trade Organization to safeguard free trade and multilateral systems and defend its lawful interests. U.S. central bank policymakers, in notes from their last meeting, said they view trade tensions as an important source of uncertainty and risk. It all comes as Wall Street continues to benefit from a bull market that extends back 9 years and 5 months to March 2009. Steve Hanke, professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's all about robust earnings and strong free cash flow by corporations.
And that is still in progress, and it's really dominating all the other noise in the system, everything coming out of Washington. It's just profits and free cash flow being generated by U.S. businesses.
Is regulation or anything else tending to inhibit this from going any further?
Well, the only inhibitor are these other factors like protectionist policies by the United States in the trade area and uncertainty about what the administration will do with, like, sanctions, for example, because every day we get either a new tariff or a new sanction, and those are things that are detrimental to commerce and free trade. So they're potentially negative. Right now, the cash flows and the earnings are so strong that they've just overwhelmed all the uncertainty associated with those tariff and sanction factors.
The Federal Reserve suggested on Wednesday that interest rates will continue to go up, but also expressed concern about the so-called trade war, trade tensions, if you will.
The Fed, in my opinion, is too tight right now, and that is indicated by broad money growth is only growing at 4.7% year over year. That indicates some tightness. The other thing that indicates tightness are two prices, and one is the dollar-euro exchange rate. The rate is below 120 right now, indicating a very strong dollar, and that indicates tightness by the Fed. The other tightness is that gold prices are hovering around $1,200 an ounce, which is a low price for gold and suggesting a tight money policy. So the Fed is another potential problem. If they do tighten up even further, as they indicated they might do, this could throw a monkey wrench into the market.
Beginning Thursday morning at 12:01 a.m., the U.S. will charge 25% import duties on another $16 billion in Chinese products. That brings the total to over 1,000 items, valued at about $50 billion. China responded, of course, with tit-for-tat sanctions, tariffs on U.S. goods, putting the total value of affected goods at $100 billion, one-seventh of the total annual U.S.-China trade.
Very bad policy on the part of the United States. We had the same general approach to Japan in the 1980s, and it turned out to be a disaster for Japan. Japan went into a massive recession in about 1990. That they really lost 20 years, Japan did, due to aggressive U.S. protectionist trade policies. So China will suffer also, but China will be different than Japan in the sense that China is a big imperial power, and I don't think it will roll over and play dead as Japan did. So we're in for a trade war.
Steve Hanke of Johns Hopkins University. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is International Edition. In the heart of New York City, one artist has created a dystopic version of Times Square, submerging it underwater and filling it with a virtual fleet of boats. VOA's Tina Trin reports on a futuristic art installation addressing a present-day concern, climate change.
Visitors to New York's Times Square are more likely to find it flooded with tourists than with water and boats. But that didn't stop one artist from trying.
It's very difficult to float 141 vessels from New York Harbor 30 feet above your head in the middle of Times Square.
To pull it off, Mel Chin used technology. The boats featured in the mixed reality piece Unmoored are virtual holograms, save for one massive physical sculpture entitled Wake.
Imagine Times Square being submerged in water, and you have to see all the boats coming in the sky. It's really amazing.
You're underwater, and you have boats above you, and then it ages as you're going along, and plankton attaches to the bottom, so it gives you a sense of the passage of time.
Visitors use either Microsoft's head-mounted HoloLens computer or a phone app to experience Unmoored. It offers a simultaneous nod to the past and a glimpse at the future, one that's affected by climate change.
To me, there's no debate. It exists.
It's a meaningful moment in time for us to pause and consider the implications that our activities, day in and day out, have on the world.
Others contend the technology still has a ways to go.
It's in its infancy, so it's not very convincing. But I get the idea, and I appreciate the start of this kind of new form of art.
With Wake and Unmoored, questioning is encouraged.
My favorite part is the beginning, and that beginning sometimes is at the end, because then the beginning of the interactions can start occurring.
According to Chin, the most original form of art is one's own search for the answers. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
New data was released at the July 2018 International AIDS Conference demonstrating the HIV epidemic is coming under control in Namibia. Results from the Namibia Population-Based HIV Impact Assessment show that 77% of all HIV-positive adults have achieved viral load suppression, a widely used measure of effective HIV treatment in a population. This surpasses the UN's target of 73% by 2020. Compared with the UNAIDS 2012 estimates, Namibia has reduced its adult HIV incidence rate by 50% in the past 5 years. Namibia has made this tremendous progress through the expansion of HIV prevention and treatment services, with a focus on viral load suppression at the individual and community level, and the swift implementation of forward-leading HIV policies. Women ages 15 to 24 still have a far higher HIV incidence rate than same-aged young men in Namibia. This highlights the continued need for expanded primary HIV prevention in young women and ensuring all HIV-infected men, particularly those ages 25 to 35, receive life-saving treatment and are virally suppressed. These exciting new data demonstrate that a community-centered approach results in high community viral suppression, which decreases the rates of new HIV infections, said Ambassador Deborah Birx, U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Global Health Diplomacy. She said several African countries are now on track to reach HIV epidemic control by 2020, accelerated progress that was only possible because of partner country political leadership and their rapid adoption of policies focusing primary prevention and treatment resources for maximum impact. Centers for Disease Control Director Robert Redfield said CDC continues to support Namibia's efforts to control its HIV epidemic, and we remain committed to global efforts to change the course of the HIV pandemic and help save lives. The population-based HIV impact assessments are funded by the U.S. government through PEPFAR and conducted by the CDC, ICAP at Columbia University, and local governmental and non-governmental partners. With PEPFAR support, four additional countries, Ethiopia, Haiti, Kenya, and Rwanda, will release HIV data on a rolling basis throughout 2019, providing an ability to chart and validate further progress toward reaching epidemic control by 2020. Together, said Dr. Birx, we are making the impossible possible, moving farther and faster toward ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030.